Right, so this is the last lecture, and here I want to try and sort of at least state and comment on, talk about the Kontsevich Seugelmann wall crossing formula. So it's sort of an amazing, it's amazing mathematical result, and it's also it's kind of the basic input into the stuff that Gayato, Moore, and Naitsky do. So although you could say that this isn't sort of a hugely, well, it can be about the geometry of bundles on the Calabi-Yau threefold, but even if you don't think of this as kind of very geometrical thing, it's the input to something very geometrical. It's the input to how Andy and co construct this hyperkähler metric. So, I mean, this is definitely of great relevance to geometry. And let me start by, I just want to tidy something up, say something a bit better than I said before, because otherwise I think we'll end up getting confused. It's to do with this business about, I said, I would just pretend your Grothendieck group is finite rank. I think we probably need to do a little bit better than that. So I need to talk about the Euler form. And the CY3 condition for a minute. Okay, so for now, D is going to be any triangulated category, so derived category of a coherent sheaves on a variety, or one of these quivery examples we were talking about. But I want to insist that it's what I would call finite time, so over a field, say, the complex numbers. So what does that mean? It means that if I take any pair of objects in here, I can form these groups of shifted morphisms. To say that this is a category over a field is saying that these are all vector spaces over this field. But what I want is that if I take the sum of them all, then the dimension of this is finite. Okay, so in other words, there are only finitely many of these as I there is, and they're all finite dimensional. So there are examples of these things. So I mean, if X is a smooth projective variety, over the complex numbers, then this is of this form. And so you really need the smooth and the projective here. If you've got a singularity on a variety, and you start computing the x groups of, say, the skyscraper at that singularity with itself, then the x groups will go on forever. There'll be infinitely many of them. They'll stop. There'll only be finitely many precisely if that was a smooth point. And then you need some kind of compactness, because otherwise the space of Homs just between any two of these guys, like the space of sections of a vector bundle, could be infinite dimensional. So you kind of need both of those things. Okay. So that's a nice condition, and what it means is that there's an invariant, the Euler form, which is just the supertrace of this vector, of this graded vector space. Right? So, chi AB minus I dimension on I. And typically this is the sort of thing you can compute, right? I mean, if you think about it, if these are just vector bundles, and let's say, for example, this is just the structure sheaf, then these HOMs in the derived category, I told you these were the X groups, but if this is the structure sheaf, these are just the cohomology groups of this vector bundle B. And of course, in general, you're not going to be able to compute the dimension of a homology group. You know, that would be something really hard, but you are going to be able to compute its Euler characteristic using Riemann-Roch. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that you can get your hands on. So yeah, let's say let's do this example. If we're doing Vx, then so what does Riemann-Roch say? Well, firstly, there's a Chern character map, which to ordinary singular cohomology of X. So here X is, well, X is as here, a smooth projective variety over C. If you're in algebraic geometry, you probably want to think about Chow rings and so on, but I can just do it like this. This is the Chern character. And then Riemann-Roch tells you that you can compute this thing. You take the Chern character of A, and you change the sign of the odd, well, you change the sign in H2 and H6, but not in H0 and H4 and so on. I mean, that's basically, you take the Chern character of the dual of this. It's the same thing. And Todd, some special class on X, the Todd class, you multiply these together in this ring and you take the top dimensional part. So, I guess, the 2D part. Okay. So that's some kind of completely practical algorithm. I mean, if someone gives you some vector bundles, then the first thing they'd better tell you, or you'd better be able to compute, is what their Chern characters are, and then this is just a computation in the cohomology ring. You have to look in the back of Hartshorn to tell you what the Todd class is, but other than that, you can do it. Okay, and then just to sort of axiomatize this, so now in a general situation, we just want a kind of version of this. So I would call this a kind of charge lattice. It's just a kind of silly name. What we want is some kind of Chern character map to some lattice. So this is some free abelian group. Not free, sorry, just abelian group. and you want to, you want a form on this. So satisfying two properties. The first property is that this should be, this should descend to the Grothendieck group. So whenever you've got a triangle, so it's additive. So the Chern character certainly has this property. And the other thing that is that it allows you, this gives you the Euler form, basically. So so the universal example, if you like, is just the Grothendieck group. Okay, so this is by definition of what the Grothendieck group means, and this, you can easily see from long exact from cohomology of long exact the cohomology functions applied to triangles, I guess, that this form does descend to the Grothendieck group. But the point is that it's not, this usually is something very big. And we'd rather replace it with something finite. And in this geometric situation, we can just take the image of the Chern character map in this finite dimensional vector space. So let's choose one of these, and let's assume that it's actually just a free finite abelian group. Sorry, what did I? A finite rank free abelian group. Okay. So that's kind of going to be fixed for the rest of the talk. So that's what I meant by pretending your Grothendieck group is finite dimensional.
Do you want something with the
non-degenerate? Certainly I don't want to assume this is non-degenerate. This could very easily be degenerate. I might ask that this map is somehow surjective onto this, but for now, let me not even assume that. So you see, this condition is just saying I'm taking any quotient of the Grothendieck group, but this is a bit more subtle. You know, I can't take some completely stupid, very small quotient because I need to still be able to compute this Euler form. Okay. And so from now on, I want to assume that we're in a CY3 condition. So D is a CY3 triangulated category. And that means that this CY3 condition just means that these groups this just comes from what Sayre duality would look like on a compact CY3, but it's just kind of an abstraction.
It's slightly confusing because you're not saying that this one here, gamma equals the cohomology, is that doesn't work. Right? That's not an example.
Gamma does work. What's wrong?
What's the pairing on cohomology?
This thing.
Oh, that's a weird thing. Okay.
I mean, it's not so weird, right? I mean, this is just... I mean, on cohomology classes, this is just... I mean, modulo this little duality thing here.
Yes, okay. Just a little add this extra bit. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Is this a condition or data? Do we actually give forms that realize that duality?
There are various different definitions of what CY3 means, and I mean the weakest possible, which is just that there are these isomorphisms. Just that there should exist condition. Yeah, that this space should be naturally dual to that one. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the natural thing certainly would be to ask that this is functorial in D. I mean, I'm trying to dig out where, in my memory, where I would actually use that functoriality. I mean, it would kind of be stupid to not ask for it.
Or it's a statement about the dimension.
Yeah.
The way you said it, so.
Yeah, well, mostly it is just going to... That's all I'm going to need, actually. Okay. We can play spot the error, but... spot where it's necessary. But for the vast majority, what I'm really wanting is just that the dimensions of these two things are the same. yeah. Right. Right, and the point is that this implies that this Euler form is skew symmetric. Okay. And I'm gonna assume that my form here is skew symmetric as well. I guess it doesn't formally follow, but if this map is not surjective, but let's assume that. And let's just recall the example of the quiver. We had this kind of... This was this kind of Ginzburg algebra construction. So it was of a particularly kind of simple CY3 category, whether it was generated by a bunch of objects and we knew about the X between them. So in this case, K0 of D is just Z to the N. So let's say the vertices. This N is the number of vertices. So vertices of Q are labeled by 1 to N. There's a simple module for each vertex, and it's nji minus nij, where nij equals number of arrows from I to j. Okay, so when you're in this kind of situation, The Grothendieck group has a canonical basis. It's given by these classes of these simple modules, and since the number of x1s was given by the arrows in the quiver, you can and the x2s are dual to x1s, you can easily see this formula. Okay. So there's always this skew symmetric form knocking around in this game.
And can you just take one second? How common why is this a Calabi-L3? Where does it come from?
Why is this category a Calabi-L3?
Yeah.
Because it was constructed to be so.
I mean, just define, that's what you wanted it. But
yeah, that's what I wanted it. I mean, given
that's how you define the higher things.
Yeah, I mean, given a quiver, I mean, a quiver is just a load of combinatorial data, right? You could construct various categories. They could be CY2, they could be CY3, they could be dimension 1. There are various different things you can do with a quiver. But I've chosen to do this one because we're looking for examples of CY3s. I mean, you know, a quiver is a very basic thing. It's not, you know, it's basically a matrix. You know, you can do a lot of different things with it, but this is what we've chosen. Right, and what's going to be important in this story is a certain torus, algebraic torus, which is canonically this. So, of course, this is a copy of C star to the n. And let me just labour this, because at some point this will get slightly confusing. Let's just be the functions on T. are naturally, of course, indexed by now the elements of gamma. So, in other words, gamma is now the character lattice of this torus, and this is, of course, isomorphic to, if you choose a basis, something like this. You know, and under this correspondence, x alpha is going to go to x 1 alpha 1 x n alpha n, where, you know, alpha in this basis is alpha 1. Okay, so sorry to labour this, but, you know, at some point these are going to be generating functions. It's important to realise that generating functions kind of in the xi's can be thought of as functions on this torus. Okay, and now what does the Euler form buy for you? It gives you a Poisson bracket on this, so Poisson structure on T is given by this. Okay. So in the case that your Euler form is non-degenerate, you can think of this as coming from a symplectic structure on the torus, an invariant symplectic structure on, you know, the, yeah. In the case that the Euler form is non-degenerate, it gives you a pairing on the dual of K, or dual of gamma, which is just the tangent space to the torus, and then I can just translate that around the torus and get a symplectic structure on it, and that would be the corresponding Poisson thing. But what's naturally going on is a Poisson structure. So the Kontsevich-Soderman-Wall crossing formula is going to end up being a formula involving automorphisms of this torus. Right, okay, so that was the kind of. Let's talk about invariants and wall crossing now. So just to be definite, D is a definitely, I'm always in the CY3 situation now, and we've fixed this map from the group to gamma. It's charge lattice. That's fixed. And recall we had something about this space of stability conditions. Where this now is space of stability conditions. Where I'm insisting that this central charge maps via gamma. So factors via this. Okay, so it's no big deal. So this guy is a complex manifold. And there's this local homeomorphism. as a local homeomorphism. Okay, and remember we had this example, maybe we'll come back to right at the end, where this is some space of quadratic differentials on a surface, and this is kind of taking the periods of those quadratic differentials. Right, and so what's the basic picture? So at each point, so this is now a complex manifold parameterizing all the different ways of saying which objects are stable in your category. And at each point, you basically have a picture getting mapped into C. You have a collection of arrays countably many in general, but certainly there are plenty of interesting examples where there are finitely many, so don't worry about that for now. So countably many rays of the form L, and then to each one plus corresponding subcategories of semi-stables of that given phase. So in terms of those pictures I was drawing before, remember I was always drawing a kind of film strip picture of the category. This has now kind of been wrapped around these phases were, I mean, I've taken exponential or something, these phases which were originally kind of just moving horizontally along are now kind of wrapped around, and there is this periodicity p phi shifted by 1 is p phi phi plus 1. So it's really just kind of a circle of stuff. But so these rays, these rays are kind of lines through the points where some semi-stable object is getting mapped, right? So I mean this central charge function on gamma is mapping your lattice into C, and in some kind of in a linear way, but in some potentially fairly crazy way, and these rays are spanned by lattice points. I mean, that's why there's countably many for starters. But okay. And then what happens when you move Z, of course, is that these rays all move, right? So these rays move around and they may collide and separate again. So there's some kind of complicated story going on here.
Say again, where the accountability comes from?
Accountability comes from
Gamma is countable?
Yes, because gamma is countable. I mean, each ray corresponds. Yeah, exactly.
So, what is that map from gamma to
C? Well, it's just any random map you want. So I just choose some. I mean, potentially it's any random map, right? Because this is a local homeomorphism, I mean, it's just, in coordinate form, Z of alpha equals some Zi alpha I, where Zi's and C are absolutely arbitrary. So, it's potentially horrible, but right. So, in good cases, you can form that. So, including quivers, you can form moduli spaces of these guys, moduli stacks. Let's label them M sigma alpha. So this is the stack of semi-stable objects E with character with charge E equals alpha. Okay. And in the stability condition sigma. So as I vary in my complex manifold, these spaces will change. And that's what wall crossing is. So I'll give you a completely concrete example in a minute. Maybe too concrete. So, but yeah, as... these moduli spaces are locally constant in some sense, but undergo discrete changes, discrete jumps. Say, so that, and this is wall crossing.
So the CH of E doesn't depend on the stability condition.
No.
Of C.
No,
it's just
that's like
should have semi-stable dependence.
Yeah,
that's
yeah, 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 absolutely. Yeah, please ask as many questions as possible because I realise this is kind of it's a confusing picture. And of course, the wall crossing is not confusing to any algebraic geometer. We, you know, people have been studying that for 20 or more years. I mean, we're used to the fact that as you change the polarisation, the class of Giesecke stable objects, you know, will be locally constant and then will jump across a wall. This is just some version of that. I mean,
so they are literally constant locally. I mean, or do you come spiritually?
What's the?
It really is like that.
I mean, certainly in the quiver case, it really is like that. Let me see. So what's happening? Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So if you fix a charge. If you fix a class in gamma, then indeed the space of stability conditions breaks up into a locally finite union of chambers such that the moduli stack is completely constant in each chamber. And then you have wall crossing. If you ask about all alpha at once, then of course you'll get a big mess. But that was true for Giesecke stable bundles as well. I mean, the walls can be dense if you ask for all Chern characters at once, but don't do that. So yeah. So it's not morally true, it completely is true. Yeah.
On the other hand, there is some continuously varying family of categories, at least morally speaking, right? At least in half scale, because it's supposed to be a moduli space of the mirror, right?
That's some kind of very deep and very unknown conjecture would be that this space of stability conditions is also like a moduli space of some mirror category, and indeed that would be varying, but that's kind of out of the picture at the minute. So, I mean, if we were talking about derived category of Kieran Sheaves on X, that other system of categories would be the derived category of Kieran Sheaves on the mirror of X, so completely different category. And but best not to think about that now, I mean, that's kind of up in the air. So, I mean, in a way, although this kind of all sounds a little bit high-tech maybe, this is actually a simplified version of wall crossing where, I mean, you know, Thaddeus or somebody would have studied, Giesecke stability where there were a whole bunch of parameters, you know, the stability parameters weren't just a bunch of complex numbers. There were some, you know, polynomial and, you know, in many ways it's more complicated. This is kind of a simplified version of all that. So let's just do a completely simple-minded example so we completely understand what's going on. So, so I'll just take basically the simplest possible quiver. This is the, and I mean Ginzburg algebra. But in a way, we're not going to care about that because, so this has a, as I told you, the derived category of the Ginzburg algebra always has a heart inside it, and this really is just representations of this quiver. The difference between the Ginzburg algebra and just the derived category of this quiver is not visible in the heart. It's only in the derived stuff you can see the difference. And so what does the representation of this category look like? Well, of this quiver, there are only three indecomposables, and they basically fit into a short exact sequence like this. So this is the representation, the simple representation at that vertex. This is the simple representation at the other vertex. And because there's an arrow between these two vertices, that means there's a unique extension, which is the thing you get by putting the identity there. Okay, so I'm fond of saying that this is kind of, you know, in algebraic geometry, we're used to thinking about the dual numbers we're used to thinking about C epsilon epsilon over epsilon squared as a kind of disembodied tangent vector, right? And you consider maps of that into your variety, that tells you about the tangent space. This is a disembodied short exact sequence, this category. So, you know, and functors from this into your category will precisely just pick out short exact sequences. So since wall crossing is precisely about short exact sequences and changing the order of them, this is kind of the most primitive example. Right, and as so, I'm not going to tell you about the stability conditions on this whole category, although this has been computed by someone you've hired, so you can ask him about it when he arrives. It's kind of interesting. You get the well, you basically get the modular curve, which is pretty bizarre. Why you would get the modular curve from such a simple thing? But
so there's no potential.
There is no potential. There is not even room for a potential because there are no cycles. But yeah, absolutely. W equals zero. Yeah. Thanks. Sorry, is it the Calabi-Yau-3 code? Yeah, so I fixed it up so it is. So, as I said, for any quiver and any potential, you can make a CY3 category using this Ginzburg algebra construction. This is not the derived category of this representation. So, I mean, I really want to write CY3 here. This is not the derived category of that. But it has a heart, which is exactly the same. It's this kind of thing that you have to get used to, that the heart of a T-structure does not determine the whole thing.
Base of the modular curve or the total space? The stab D.
Yes, stab of D is the base of the modular curve, or really the base of the modular curve with a one form. So it's a two dimensional thing. Okay, so we're not going to try and understand that for now, but we understood this thing, right? I said that when you have a finite length heart, which this guy certainly is, then a stability condition, you just have to choose these numbers, right? And so what happens so now we're really just talking about the most trivial minded thing, we're just thinking about this abelian category and thinking about stability conditions on that, and basically, I mean, here's stab of A, there's basically one wall and two different things that can happen. Either you put Z of S1 on the right side, let's put it like this. Remember, I said that you're just kind of free to choose where you put the central charge of the simple objects and then everything else follows, or you put them the other way around. Z of this thing, did I call it E? Yeah. Has to be the sum of these two, because Z is additive on short exact sequences. Now, and Z of E would be here as well, but I didn't draw it because it would be unstable. Right, because... yes. Phase is... yes. Right, the inequality, which objects are stable, every sub-object has to have smaller phase. And that's not true in this case. Right, so here there are three stable objects. And here there are two stable objects. And you can see exactly this discontinuous change if you think about the class alpha equals 1, 1, which is the class of E. Then the moduli space on this side is a point, and on this side it's empty. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on. Now, so this way you get to something a bit more meaty. So Joyce and Kinsevich, essentially.
So just one law. Shapelessness
Just two chambers, yeah. There's just two chambers in this region.
Oh.
You know, here we've drawn H. If we then go on to...
it's really H2 mod, so...
Well, it's more that this space is covered by copies of this, and in each of those there will be a wall just like this, actually.
Oh, okay.
So you can define invariants. So basically we want to... Yeah, so... and let's... So in the rational numbers, so for each charge gamma, and depending on your stability condition, and so very roughly, and you know we'll discuss. I mean, in some places this is true, but not very many. This is the Euler characteristic of this moduli stack. Okay, so when is this true? Actually, this is true if all objects, all sigma semi-stable objects of charge gamma, charge alpha, are actually stable. So they don't, you know, you can guess the definition of stable. That inequality should be strict.
And this is in the generality that you...
Well, so what generality are we in now? I mean, if we're honest, I mean, given that I told you that there are no stability conditions on the Calabi R threefold that anybody knows, then we're basically talking about quivers here. So we're certainly in that generality, any quiver. If someone were to be able to define stability conditions on CY3, I don't think this would be a problem. You just need the existence of these moduli stacks, which is, you know, the sort of thing that algebraic geometers know how to do. But at the minute, yeah, any quivery example, you can do this completely rigorously. Go on.
There used to be something, I remember in Kansander Stuggleman's papers, which I think were about this, there was an issue about something they called orientation data.
that comes about when you're trying to basically categorify these invariants. And it also comes about when you try and prove anything about these invariants using their framework. But Joyce's framework, you see, basically what Kuncevich and Soberman do, it'll maybe come clear a bit later, they basically categorify everything. Instead of taking Euler characteristics, they're taking something like Poincaré polynomials, and just at the end, they set Q equals 1 to get the Euler characteristic. Whereas, in a sense, Joyce's framework works at Q equals 1 from the start. It's pretty technical. But it does work and gives you the rigorous if I wanted to rigorously define these things, and I do, I would use Joyce's work, but somehow Kuncevich and Soberman came up with a much nicer conceptual framework, conceptual statement of the wall crossing formula, as you know, so I'll write that in a minute. But I should say that the picture that comes out from this has been used in many examples where you don't have, strictly speaking, a stability condition of this type. You can apply the same picture to Giesecke stability and things. And so the technology I'm sort of referring to here has been used to prove results about Donaldson-Thomas curve counting invariants on Calabi R threefolds. I mean, there's definitely been non-trivial stuff come out of the picture that's described here. but that's... Anyway. Okay. What was I going to say? Right. And the point is that these invariants are going to jump. So in this case, you know, we could have n sigma. We've got alpha here. This is going to be 1. And here, n sigma alpha is going to be 0. Okay, and what we want to know, and what Kuncevich and Soberman amazingly give you, is a formula for expressing all these invariants at one point in terms of all the invariants at a different point. So you completely understand how these things change. So how do these vary with sigma? Here's the answer. It's a little bizarre to start with, so let me so you should assemble them into a generating function. What did I call that? I guess we've lost our picture of the rose, so let's draw it. Okay, so we have certain rays on which semi-stable objects can potentially live, countably many of them. So for each of those rays, I form a generating function. I just sum up all these invariants for charges alpha which lie on this ray. Okay, so in this picture here, if we were in this stability condition, there would be three of these rays. I would get one generating function for each. This generating function would all just be about multiples of this. So this would be counting objects of class N. You know, this would be an invariant to do with objects of this class. 0N. Okay, so... right. So you view this as a function. View this as a function. On that torus we had before. Okay, so, I mean, we don't know whether this converges, but that's not going to be a problem at all. I'll explain that later. But for now, just think about this as kind of converging. And then we think of this as defining an automorphism of T. That's not the right way around. That's acting on T. Basically, the Hamiltonian flow. So think of this as Hamiltonian on T, which is a symplectic torus, which is a Poisson torus, and take the Hamiltonian flow. So what does that really mean? I mean, just kind of algebraically, how does the pullback act on some function x beta? Well, you take the Poisson bracket of this thing, which, remember, was just sort of some simple thing involving the Euler form. This Poisson bracket with this element will define an automorphism of functions on the torus, and I take the exponential of that and apply it to x beta. Right. So, I mean, conceptually, if you just want to be a bit vague, think of this as a Hamiltonian. It generates a Hamiltonian flow on the torus. Take that flow at time one. That gives you an automorphism of the torus. If you actually want to compute anything, what does that really mean?
What does that lesson mean? Does that mean really stick x beta in first and then exponentiate what you get?
No, it doesn't mean that. It means...
is that x to the beta?
This is x to the... I mean, this is a character.
Okay. So there's some big powers of whatever that pairing function is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean... I'll rewrite this in another way in a minute, actually. I mean, so, yeah, actually, I mean, yeah. If you're doing things algebraically, probably this is not the best... I mean, this is a true statement. It's probably not the best way to think. But conceptually, you know, that's what's going on.
Conceptually, is it clear that the time one flow is algebraic?
Algebraic, as in... No, and so, yeah, so I mean, it's not even clear that this converges in any sense to give a function, and so this is not true. But I can perfectly well do this in a ring, you know, instead of working in the ring, basically I can do all this calculation, I claim, in this ring, rather than in... rather than there, which will be scary. I can do it in this, as long as I'm just thinking about all invariants in some convex sector. Okay, and I can do that. So I can work convex sector. We'll discuss that after I state the formula. But yeah, I have zero control on how these functions are growing with alpha. This could just be a crazy formal sum, even before I take its exponential. So, but nonetheless, this is a completely effective technique for determining these things. Right.
Is it clear that this summation index set is some kind of cone?
Well, this one, yeah, this one certainly is, because it's all the things that get mapped onto this ray. So you couldn't have alpha and minus alpha in there. And in fact, the same would be true if I chose any half plane and just considered all the stuff getting mapped into this upper half plane. That would be fine. Then everything would... Then, basically...
So, the alphas that are actually in that index set is a cone in gamma.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a much nicer way of saying it. Thank you. Is that okay? Oh. Yeah. That's a yes, yes. I guess what am I trying to say? That the Lie algebra of vector fields on the torus has a sub-Lie algebra, which is the vector fields generated by Hamiltonian flows and stuff here, and that's I can just take the formal completion of that, something like that. But actually, when you do it algebraically, this is not a very mysterious thing. You're just looking at automorphisms of a power series ring. So here's... So the wall-crossing formula is as follows. So you take a sector, take a convex sector, and what shall I call that? Sigma in C. So that's... That's not very simple. Here's sigma. And everything's going to be happening inside that sector, which is exactly the point. So the stuff in the lattice gamma, which is getting mapped by Z into this sector, forms a cone. And then the wall-crossing formula says that if I take the product over all rays in this sector in the clockwise order of these automorphisms, then this is constant as sigma varies, as the stability conditions varies, and providing one thing, it's kind of obvious that no active ray crosses the boundary of the sector. So in other words, you're taking the product over a bunch of rays, those rays for which there are any semi-stable objects living there at all, and any of these invariants. I mean, for your average ray, there is no class in K-theory which maps onto it, and there is, the invariants are all zero and there's nothing going on. But there are certain rays which we would call active. And as long as none of those cross the boundary, I mean, obviously, if one of those comes out, then your product is going to get screwed up. But as long as they just mess around in there, then the product is constant. So, I mean, what morally this is saying is that suppose you have two rays like this with their associated automorphisms of the torus, and then these rays are just kind of controlled by the central charge of some object. Suppose we now vary the stability condition, vary the central charge, so these two rays collide. So we've just got one big ray with more objects on it now. And all multiples of these things. The condition is that this new invariant, which will be something different because there may be, extensions of objects here and here will suddenly become semi-stable when they weren't before. This, nonetheless, the invariant for this thing is just the product, or rather, I guess, the composition of these two automorphisms of the torus. And then if this ray can now separate the other way, so that Z alpha is coming out the other way, and you will be able to understand the change. So it's an amazing formula. I just think it's a very beautiful thing. Maybe I'll even leave that, because we'll probably come back to that example. Any questions? Is the formula?
I was hoping that you were going to say that it was going to be interpreted as saying that some function, you know, could be glued when we sort of glued a bunch of tori together.
I'm not going to say that. Sorry to disappoint you.
Interpretation? Or?
Maybe we'll come back to that at the end. The way I would interpret this, and sort of what appears in Gaotu, Moore and Naitsky is that it makes sense. It means it. So what does it mean? It means it makes sense to ask for a continuous function depending on a stability condition and a point in C star, taking values in the torus, maybe the better way is sort of, don't think about this, the same thing, but think about a map from X, from C star to the torus, which really is depending on sigma, and you could ask for this function to satisfy the following thing, that discontinue in such a piecewise holomorphic, but satisfying the following thing, that when I cross a ray, when my parameter t or zeta crosses a ray, that x sigma is fixed in all this, this ray is called L. Okay, so I think of a function on this C star, or on this C. This is the same C I've been drawing all along. This is the C where the central charges are living, and I can ask for a function on that space such that it's kind of holomorphic, but it jumps when I cross one of these rays, and it jumps by precisely this automorphism of the torus. I could always ask for such a thing, so I shouldn't say sort of function like that, but continuously varying with sigma, so the stability condition. Okay, because can you see from this? I would be asking for the function to jump by this amount across there and jump by this amount across there, and then I can kind of continuously vary in the stability condition direction, and suddenly I'm asking just for one jump, and if anything's going to work, that jump better be the product of these two jumps if it's going to kind of continuously vary with the stability condition space. So this is kind of what the wall crossing formula immediately tells you to think about. It's kind of a Stokes phenomenon type thing. And so this is kind of the starting off point for Andy and for GMN's work. They ask for, this is part of their Riemann-Hilbert problem. This is the jumping condition, and then they would also well, I mean, I could even say the other condition while I'm at it. So you can also ask for x sigma of t to look like, let's just write it like this, x minus z over t as t goes to zero. I mean, so what does that really mean? I mean, in coordinates, this means the element of the torus, e to the z1 e zn, where, you know, central charge of your basis element, I mean, these are these complex numbers that came up before. So, and of course, this has got an over t in it.
Are you changing from c to z?
Thank you. That was not intention.
Z is sigma?
Z is basically sigma, yes. Remember, the stability conditions are determined by the central charge locally. Yeah, so...
Oh, that's what Z is.
Z is a proxy for the stability condition because locally it's, I mean, that's what's giving you the coordinates. I mean, I don't know the best way of saying this. I mean, yeah.
And why would you do this? Or why would you expect such an asymptotic order?
Well, you might expect such an asymptotic if you knew about Stokes' phenomena for irregular connections just for GLN. So really this is kind of like a Stokes type problem where it's taking values in the group of automorphisms of the torus. I guess symplectic automorphisms of this torus. But if you previously studied the group G equals GLN, of course this is an old story, and solutions to certain differential equations taking values in this have precisely this kind of jumping behavior and these kind of asymptotic limits. But, you know, I'm not the person who should be explaining this. Andy, you have Andy to do his job.
But I would have said the same thing.
Good. Oh. It's very nice to hear. Okay, so I'm not really here to vouch for this, but this statement is certainly something that, you know, is definitely a kind of a direct and a nice way of thinking about what the wall crossing formula is telling you. Yeah, and then you pop another condition on these x sigma, and you hope they exist. And let's not go into that just now. so what was I going to tell you? Can 3 pages be so confusing? Ah, yeah, okay. So in a way, this is kind of beginning to answer the question I stated right at the start of the first lecture, is, you know, what is the geometric structure on this space of stability conditions? Well, this is the geometric structure, that at each point you have a bunch of rays and you have a bunch of automorphisms of a torus which behave in some kind of nice way as you move. And that looks a lot like kind of Stokes data for a connection or something. And, you know, again, GMN, you know, hopefully the output of GMN will, one of the things that will come out of it is understanding the correct structure on stab that all this kind of implies. But so far, this is as far as we've got. This is the natural structure that exists on the space of stability conditions. Let me actually compute this thing in an example. Well, not compute it, but tell you the answer. So suppose on some ray, suppose some ray L just contains a single spherical object, so say rigid stable object S and its direct sums. So, I mean, one of the things I haven't really kind of emphasized yet is, although I just drew these stable objects, there's a whole bunch more semi-stables, which are just the direct sums of all these things for themselves. then what you can see is that, you know, the corresponding subcategory, P phi or P L, this is actually just equivalent to the vector category of vector spaces over C, right? So it's just, you know, C to the D is just going to direct D copies of this. I mean, so there's a little piece of your category that's very simple. It's just on this ray, it's got S, it's got S direct sum 2, S direct sum 3, and so on. And it turns out, although I don't think I'm going to have much time to say where this comes from, it's interesting to know, I suppose, but these invariants give you for that. So I told you that if everything is stable in a given class, then you just get the Euler characteristic. Well, the only time that's happening is when D equals 1. And I guess that is in fact giving you 1. So that's a
multiple cover formulas?
Yeah, you can think of this as a multiple cover formula. I mean, that's what's going to come up next, yeah. But I mean, that, so far that's just a computation. There is some definition of these invariants, and that's the answer you get. So this Hamiltonian thing for this ray is now just x to the d alpha over d squared. So this is d greater than 1. So this is kind of why you get these ubiquitous polylogarithms coming up, dilogarithms coming up. Because if you just have the simplest possible situation where you just have a single rigid stable object, then already this Hamiltonian function is the dilog. But I don't think you should, you know, I don't like to take that too seriously. Because I mean to me that's just a gadget which is giving you the Hamiltonian, which gives you a particularly nice automorphism. I mean, so this is now an exercise. Work out what the exponential of this guy, you know, yeah, work out what this is, and the answer is that it's x beta 1 plus x alpha alpha beta. Okay.
Can you twist this flow thing, or?
Yeah. So if you take this as your Hamiltonian on your torus at any flow distance 1, you get this transformation.
Oh, yeah, that's good. And you say that thing is the dilogarithm?
Yeah, I mean, it is the dilogarithm. I mean, if you think of this as, you know, x to the alpha, that's the dilog. So I would call this transformation, I guess, k alpha. Okay, so this is some kind of cluster. Anyway, it's cluster-y. So somehow that's. And then in this example, what does the wall crossing formula say? It says, remember, we had two walls where here we had. I guess this side I didn't have this one, so this must be S2, S1, and this must be. So on this side you have to take the product of these corresponding automorphisms, so you get K on in 0, 1, composed with K in 1, 0. Right, this automorphism depends on a character of my torus, and so I'm putting these characters, which are corresponding to the charges of these two elements, and that should be equal to. I mean, So we can take our sector to just be something big over here. No interesting rays are crossing the boundary of this sector, so this wall crossing formula should apply. And then on the other side, of course, there are now three things. Okay, so that should be what the wall crossing formula says in this case. You know, and it had to be something kind of interesting, because it says the product of two things is equal to the product of three things, which is, you know, not something you commonly come across. I just want to kind of finish with some comments. I guess we had this one already. So basically, yeah. I mean, we can see, actually, I mean, this is a good example. This is not an automorphism of the torus. It's a birational automorphism of the torus, right? So if this x is equal to minus 1 or something, and this is equal to minus 1, then... You know, this is not a well-defined automorphism of the torus. It's a birational automorphism of the torus.
Do you happen to know, do they... I've known about this paper course forever, but I've never even looked at this as a conceived Stokelman. Do they propose this as a way of building the mirror?
I've no idea. I mean, you look, there's a lot of...
It looks like you could interpret this thing. I think this is what you do, right? You could say that what you do is you glue together a bunch of little tori. They would use these... That's one way to interpret the wall crossing formula.
It's the wrong dimension. It's not building the mirror. It's building some other modular space. It's not Calabria threefold. It's building a modular space, which is what any builds. But it's not. I mean, it's a modular space of something living in a different theory.
I'll bet you $20 this is.
No,
just our construction of the mirror. It's almost.
Well,
It's not threefold.
It's.
No, I think kind of both of you are right. That's the thing. I mean, I came here thinking exactly the same as David, but then it seems that in certain examples, this is related to the construction of the mirror in a way that I don't fully understand yet. But yeah, certainly morally, this is supposed to be producing the manifold M that Andy produces.
It's just glued together by those little tori glued together, right?
Yeah, but it's not the mirror of... I mean,
yeah,
it's the category was the drive category.
Yeah.
Threefold. You wouldn't be making the mirror of that. You'd be making the mirror of something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. What is the mirror of... Yeah. That is... What does that mean by the one box?
Yeah. Right, so we did that remark already. So then I just wanted to say about... DT I didn't even say DT invariant, which is unusual these days, so let me say it. there are basically kind of two problems with defining these numbers, these numbers n sigma alpha, which, you know, morally or vaguely are the other characteristic of this stack. Okay, so there are two problems, and they're kind of, at least to start with, they're orthogonal to each other. So one is the fact that M sigma alpha is a stack. Okay, and the other one is the fact that even if it weren't a stack, M sigma alpha is not of the expected dimension. Okay, and it's kind of important to sort of, at least to start with, at least separate these things in your mind, what the problems are. So so this is the thing that kind of classically went to, you know, Richard Thomas's thesis. This is DT theory. If this was just a moduli scheme, he would tell you how to take its Euler characteristic using virtual cycles. And then there was this theory of Berend, Kai Berend, which says that, you know, a DT sigma alpha equals the Euler characteristic, a weighted Euler characteristic of this guy with respect to some constructible function, which is depends only on the singularities. So this is Berend's constructible function. So this is if M sigma alpha is a scheme. You still have to do all this stuff. And if it's smooth, so if M sigma alpha is in addition smooth, then the output of this guy is dt sigma alpha is minus 1 to the dimension times the Euler characteristic. Okay. Andy, you look horrified.
No.
So you can imagine, one thing this has the consequence is that it sprinkles signs liberally throughout everything. That's kind of an alarming thing. But the point is that, the other important thing about these guys, if you define them like this, is that they're deformation invariant. Okay, so, but let's say we don't care about that now. Suppose we're just caring about the wall crossing formula.
Well, here we would vary sigma.
No, exactly. So there are two deformations you can do. Imagine you're on a Calabi-Yau threefold. You could vary the complex structure or you could vary the stability condition. Right. And if you want to vary the complex structure, you'd better do this properly. So you'd better use DT invariants. But if you're just interested in varying the stability condition and understanding wall crossing, it doesn't matter. This stuff makes no difference. It just sprinkles signs everywhere. So basically, you can do without the virtual cycle. And actually, putting the virtual cycle in, now people have told you how to do it. It doesn't change anything. But this is a completely different problem. And this is solved by kind of Joyce's Nativik Hall algebra stuff. And that's what's giving you all these kind of 1 over n squareds and things. I mean, actually, if you do it over in this theory, so here we got a minus 1 to the d minus 1 over d squared. Here you just get a 1 over d squared. So you just kind of change the sign. But this is kind of the really tricky stuff, which I'm kind of pleased I don't have time to talk about.
So you can see the 1 over d squared in this picture? Like for d equals 2, you can see a quarter?
Yeah, but you can't. I mean, this rationality, this 1 over, this quarter, so the difference between the virtual cycle and the non-virtual cycle is just the difference between a quarter and a minus quarter. But where you're getting the quarter from is all about this fact that this is a stack. And that I'm basically not explaining. And I mean, I could explain, given another hour, but I don't think you'd thank me. But there's another reason why you might want to take these DT things as well. So let me just explain that, because it finally gives the links with, finally gives the kind of definition of BPS invariance in physics, which is that... So you can do a multiple cover formula. So you do multi trick. So define, insist that the following thing is true. Alpha equals n beta. Okay. So this... Define the omega beta by this. Okay, so if we did this in this example, we would just get the answer. We would just get the answers omega 1, 0 equals 1, omega 0, 1 equals 1, and omega 1, 1 equals 1. And all other things would be 0. So this is only. Right, because all these 1 over d squared would get gobbled up by this formula. Okay, so obviously it's kind of a good thing to do from that point of view. And another reason is that now this thing, this Hamiltonian, this symplectomorphism, which is crucial in the wall crossing formula, you can just write it in terms of these BPS. So these things BPS, these are BPS invariants, supposedly. So that now you just write it like this. Right, so you have some particular automorphism, which is this one, that you it's a pretty simple thing. And in terms of that, these automorphisms are just given by that. You could do what I did here. I mean, I've done this for DT invariants, but I could have just done it for these n sigmas. Could have done the same thing. I would have had to stick a sign in there. I could have done the same thing, but there's one kind of crucial thing, is that there's a conjecture. If you do it in the BPS world, you only get alpha or integers, allegedly. So, which is definitely not true if you don't put the virtual cycle in. So, you know, there are kind of two reasons why DT is better. One is deformation invariant, and the other it has integrality properties. Those things are probably related, because maybe you can kind of deform to somewhere where there's only finitely many of them and count them or something. But
non-negative?
I don't want to say that. No. No, it can't be non-negative, surely. Andy?
Yeah. If that only is the usual omega that we write.
Yeah, it's good. They can be positive or negative. Yeah, so those are the two advantages over the BPS, of the kind of DT story. But from if you just want to understand wall crossing, then you can kind of, at least to start with, forget that. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
Further questions? Comments?
Do you know how much progress there's been on that conjecture, actually?
Well, I'm afraid not, no. yeah. It must be known in some cases, I guess. But maybe not very many. Yeah, I think Dominic Joyce was working on it for a while and hasn't solved it yet, which kind of puts me off trying. Yeah, don't know.
Okay, let's thank Tom again.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for putting it up.